In chapter 7, you mentioned E.L. St. Clair and some of the important contributions that he made to what we might call Orthodox confessionalism among Free Will Baptists in the early 20th century. One of the things you say following this period happened, and I would say, I guess, after the formation of the National Association in 1935, you imply that confessional subscription somewhat weakened alongside the, quote, intrusion in some areas of alien forms of church government, unquote. And that really got me to thinking about a lot of different things. And I guess to put it simply, do you think that our vulnerability to those kind of problems in some ways is sort of hardwired into the type of polity that we initially adopted? Or maybe in a more sanguine way, I guess you could say, are those just unfortunate developments that just weren't adequately confronted?
Yeah, it's a good question. Well, you know, by the way, E.L. St. Clair is one of the most understudied figures in modern Free Will Baptist history. And in the first quarter of the 20th century, he was probably the most influential Free Will Baptist in America. And he has a wonderful balance between cooperation with people who are not Free Will Baptists for the sake of the gospel and for the sake of helping the poor and benevolent work and mission work and things of that nature. And yet he is very clear on his Free Will Baptist distinctions, his distinctive teachings. And so St. Clair has this wonderful balance between irenics and polemics, to use a little phrase that that Thomas Oden often uses, where you want to cooperate with people in the gospel where you can, and then in certain issues you don't, and you ordain people who are of biblical faith and order, you know, and you do not have that same sort of, you don't extend those same privileges of ordination and church fellowship to those who don't understand that and don't believe and practice it. And yet there's still this willingness to embody unity with people who are outside of your confessional tradition, your denomination. So St. Clair is a wonderful figure in that regard. And I remember one of the, he wrote this long poem where he's like comparing a Church of Christ individual and a missionary Baptist. You know, back then they called kind of Southern Baptist missionary Baptist. And so he has the missionary Baptist, then he has what he calls the hard shell Baptist, the primitive Baptist, the very, you know, kind of old hardline Calvinist primitive Baptist. And then he has a Mormon, and he has a Seventh-day Adventist, and I think he has a Methodist, and then he has a Free Will Baptist. And so they're like dialoguing, and he's got this great long poem that ranges pages, you know, scores of pages. Now, I shouldn't say it's a great long poem, because, you know, it's not the best verse in the world, but it's certainly engaging, and it's great. It's a great read. And so what he's doing there is he's really talking about this Orthodox confessionalism and how you relate your denominational distinctives, your narrower confessional beliefs to the beliefs of the wider Orthodox body of Christ. So he is saying that the Mormons are not that, for example. And that the people who accept, you know, certain higher critical theories of inspiration that were floating around at the time that he was writing are not articulating an Orthodox confessional theology. And then there are others who are, that we can, you know, have fellowship in the gospel with, but do not articulate the proper theology of baptism, or of the proper theology of salvation. And so St. Clair is really good to read on this, and I wish somebody would go back and take all of his very folksy theological works and put them into one, put them in a set of complete works. But essentially, I do think that the 20th century represented an erosion of what you referred to, and I may have referred to in that chapter, as Orthodox confessionalism or confessional orthodoxy or whatever you want to put, however you want to put it. And really with confessionalism just meaning people that want to have ministers and churches that subscribe to confessions of faith. Not necessarily members of churches, not necessarily that every member of your church has to be has to believe every jot and tittle of your confession of faith. For example, not every member of Freeway's church necessarily has to believe in the possibility of apostasy. You can have someone who believes in unconditional eternal security and still receive them as a member of the church. But you would not ordain an officer, a minister or a deacon, an office bearer in the church, as who did not subscribe to the confession of the church. So anyway, that is very important to the Free Will Baptists. And it's very important to the Southern Baptists, and it's very important to the Methodists and the Episcopalians and everyone else prior to modernity. And what I just kind of casually call modernity, let's just be more specific and say the 20th century. And as modernity begins to make its presence felt in the way that people put together their faith in the 20th century, I think that confessional orthodoxy is eroded, and confessional theology is eroded, and holding ministers to a certain confessional standard or a standard of what they believe and what they practice, that's eroded. Now, by the way, I would think that most Free Will Baptists now would tend to be, most of the Free Will Baptists, like, for example, who are at this convention. You know, we're talking here at the National Association of Free Will Baptists Annual Convention. And most of the people that you and I know and talk to a lot, when they were ordained to the ministry, they were asked to subscribe to a confession of faith, whether it was the National Free Will Baptist Treatise, which had been adopted by their conference or association, or whether it was their own conference or association confession of faith. And so they were also asked if they would turn in their credentials at the point at which they could no longer subscribe to that confession. And so that's pretty commonplace in Free Will Baptists still. And yet I do see an erosion. I think you probably have a lot stronger confessional subscription, to use that language, among Free Will Baptists than you would other Baptist groups. But I do see an erosion of that. I see an erosion of that, and a lot of it has to do with the fact that ordination is not valued. It's not placed on the same level of importance as it was in bygone days. So the question that you raise about what it has to do with church government, what I mentioned specifically in that particular chapter is that we used to have a stronger system of church government than we have, than many of our conferences have now, so that holding ministers accountable for their teaching and for their beliefs and their practices and their morality was a lot bigger issue then than it is now. And it was the conference or the association or its presbytery or ordaining council, or whatever the language was used, that held these ministers accountable for that. And they would have to come and present their last year of their ministry and they would have to come to the meetings, and they would be examined, and they would be in the care of the presbytery and this sort of thing. Well, that kind of is that's kind of falling by the wayside, and that's something that is a part of our denominational past, whether north, south, east, west, Randall, Palmer, regardless of the background, of the historical background of the Free Will Baptist Association or conference that you're a part of, that is a part of your history. Being held accountable by the body of churches to which your church belongs for your belief and practice and holy living. Being held accountable as a minister. And so I think that what has eroded that, you know, when you're looking at some mainline denominations, what has eroded that has been more sort of the acids of modernity and, you know, theological liberalism and things of that nature. When you look at groups like ours, I think what has eroded it more is kind of this sort of low church evangelical non-denominational mentality. And so I think in our denomination in particular, the independent Baptist movement and the non-denominational movement, the sort of non-denominational megachurch sort of movement, has those two things have really, really eroded our commitment to our traditional sort of polity that wanted to bring churches together and bring ministers of the gospel together and hold each other accountable and really have an accountability structure for ensuring confessional orthodoxy in our churches.
Our time is slipping away, but there is a question that, you alluded to it earlier. I wanted to make sure I was able to ask. You alluded earlier to part of why you believe we see this resurgence of interest in Arminianism is due to the resurgence of Calvinism in other places and kind of the pushback that there is against that. Just trying to, you know, and there's risk in this playing prophet for a moment here. Where do you think this dialogue, this Calvinist-Arminian dialogue, it has a rich history. Where do you think it's going to go over the next, I don't know, say 10 or 15 years? Any ideas on that, impressions?
I don't know where it's going to go, Jackson, but I think that if it's going to go anywhere productively, people need to start to stop talking past each other and really listening to what others are saying. It's still amazing to me the Arminian books that I read that show a real ignorance of what Calvin himself, for example, said, or what Edward said, or what the Puritans said about salvation. And it's amazing to me the ignorance that Calvinist books have about what historical Arminians have said. Even Wesley is so much closer. You know, Wesley himself said he was within a hair's breadth of Calvinism. And even though, you know, our sort of approach, our Reformed Arminian approach, is a lot closer in many respects to Reformed theology than it is to Wesleyanism when it comes to what it means to be justified and what the nature of sin is and our inability and that sort of thing. The fact of the matter is that Wesley was a lot closer to Reformed categories in many respects than many modern day Arminians. And yet, you know, the Calvinists don't even really read or quote Wesley, let alone Arminius or, you know, Grantham or whoever. And I think that one of the things that I find disconcerting is the fact that there are people like Dr. Piccirilli and Mr. Fourlines whose works have circulated and sold quite well and are in the libraries of all these Calvinist institutions and on the shelves of many of these Calvinist brothers and sisters in Christ. And yet, we still don't see them being quoted in these books. We still see the same old arguments about basically essentially equating Arminianism to semi-Pelagianism, or suggesting that the only sort of Arminianism is Wesleyanism. And so, you know, one of the things I hope to do is for there to be more understanding and more real reading of the sources on both sides. And then here's another thing. We've got to stop throwing rocks across the moat at each other. Some of my best friends are five-point Calvinists and four-point Calvinists and Wesleyans. And I disagree with all of them, but I agree with all of them. You understand what I'm saying? In other words, we don't just need to emphasize our disagreements with people. We need to be like old E.L. St. Clair and find out where we can agree and be charitable and be, you know, joined together in mutual endeavor for Christ and for the gospel and for the church. And we know that now in our culture, we need that more than ever. And at the same time, it's healthy to disagree with people. It can be healthy. For example, I've been having this debate with some of my friends, not debate, this discussion with some of my friends about, big tent Arminianism and big tent evangelicalism and that kind of thing. And I really don't know what the answers to all that are, but I do think that it can be healthy to disagree, but to disagree in a charitable way. And I don't want to condemn my Calvinist friends and co-laborers in the gospel any more than I want to do my Wesleyan friends or my Southern Baptist friends who are once saved, always saved, sort of Baptists. So I think trying to understand each other more, trying to read the sources, and trying not to sort of engage in warfare from a distance. I think that's what we need.
It's a good word. Thank you so much for your time, and I hope that your book finds a broad audience.
Thank you very much, Jackson. Appreciate the opportunity.